A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Three infants in one night. Same symptoms. Profound lethargy. Pupils shrunk to pinpoints. Breathing so shallow, the monitors kept alarming. The attending pediatrician is running the same talk screen on the third baby, and she hasn't said it out loud yet, but something is coiling in her gut. She's not just treating patients anymore. She's just become a detective.
That scene is playing out right now in Jerusalem. As of today, June 24th, police have narrowed their investigation to a supermarket employee. But the part of this story that hardly anyone talks about is what happened before law enforcement got involved. The hours inside the emergency department, where medical staff pieced together a pattern from fragments, a parent's answer about what their baby ate, a nurse noticing the second case looked an awful lot like the first.
Daniel sent us this one, and he's asking exactly the right questions. How does that first process work? Who are the people involved? When does a clinician stop being just a clinician and start being something closer to an investigator? He wants to know whether we're looking at food contamination, a rogue doctor, or, as seems to be the case here, a rogue employee. And he's asking about the unsung heroes, the medical staff who crack cases like this before, names most people have never heard.
I love this prompt because Daniel's asking about the part of the story I lived for years without ever quite naming it. I was a pediatrician in Jerusalem. I've been in that emergency department, not this specific one, but ones like it. The handoff from medical suspicion to criminal investigation is this strange, almost invisible seam. Nobody teaches it in medical school as a formal curriculum. You learn it by being there when it happens.
We're going to pull back the curtain on that seam. What happens in the hours between this is a weird case, and we need to call the police. We'll do it through the Jerusalem case, because it's unfolding right now. But also through the history of doctors and nurses and pharmacists who've been the first to spot something deeply wrong and who saved lives because they trusted that gut feeling long enough to prove it was real.
Let's start at the moment a clinician realizes they're not just treating a patient, they're investigating a pattern.
Walk me through it. First infant comes in. What does that look like?
It looks like a mystery, and not an especially dramatic one. An infant arrives with altered mental status, lethargic, hard to rouse, breathing a little too slowly. The parents are terrified. They can't explain it. The emergency physician runs the obvious tests: blood glucose, electrolytes, septic workup, head imaging, if there's any hint of trauma. Everything comes back normal. The tox screen takes longer, but benzodiazepines aren't always on the standard rapid panel. So you're staring at a baby with a depressed central nervous system and no clear cause. You stabilize, you admit, you hope the lab calls back with something.
At that point, is anybody thinking poisoning?
Most toxic ingestions in infants present as generic symptoms: lethargy, vomiting, maybe seizures. The same presentation you'd see with a bad infection or a metabolic disorder. The first case almost always gets chalked up to "we'll figure it out eventually." The real shift happens with the second case.
Case number two arrives.
Ideally, yes. And that's what happened in Jerusalem. The cluster was tight enough temporally that the pattern became visible within hours. A second infant comes in with the same constellation: pinpoint pupils, respiratory depression, normal labs except for the thing you haven't tested for yet. Now the charge nurse looks at the board and says, "That's strange, we've got two of the same thing." And that sentence, "that's strange," is the most important diagnostic tool in epidemiology. It flips the switch from individual treatment to pattern recognition.
There's something almost literary about that. The whole investigation pivots on someone saying, "huh."
It's usually a nurse. In most documented cases where a poisoning cluster was caught early, it was a nurse or a charge nurse who first verbalized the pattern. They're the ones tracking the board. They see every patient who comes through. The physicians are often deep in individual workups. The nurse has the 30,000-foot view of the shift.
By case two, someone's suspicious. What happens next?
The attending physician gets pulled in. This is where the structured interview process begins, the thing Daniel was asking about. You sit down with the parents of both infants and go through an exposure history. Every single thing the baby ingested in the past 24 hours, every food, every formula, every medication, even the ones the parents swear couldn't possibly be relevant. You ask about who prepared the food, where it was purchased, whether the container looked normal. You ask about caregivers, visitors, anyone who had access to the baby.
That's an incredibly detailed interview. Parents must find it invasive.
They do, and that's one of the tensions we'll get into. But in the Jerusalem case, those interviews cracked it open. Both sets of parents independently named the same brand of baby food puree, purchased from the same supermarket chain. That's not a coincidence. When you hear the same product from the same location from two families who don't know each other, you've just identified your common exposure. At that point, the hospital's role shifts. You're no longer just collecting clinical history. You're gathering evidence.
Let me pin down the timeline. Case 1 arrives. Case 2 arrives. Nurse flags the similarity. Attending physician conducts exposure interviews, identifies the common product. How long until someone picks up the phone?
In a well-run emergency department, the call to the hospital's incident command happens within minutes. The attending physician notifies the infection control officer or the administrator on call. That person activates the hospital incident command system, HICS, the healthcare adaptation of the incident command structure that emergency services use. From there, the local health department is notified. They decide whether this is a public health emergency and whether law enforcement needs to be involved.
In Jerusalem, the health department would be part of the Ministry of Health.
Israel's system is fairly centralized. The district health office gets the call, dispatches an epidemiological investigation team, and if there's any suspicion of intentional contamination, which there clearly was here, they loop in the police. The whole cascade, from the nurse saying, "That's strange," to law enforcement opening a criminal investigation, can happen in under 4 hours.
That's remarkably fast. But the handoff isn't clean, is it? The medical staff don't just hand over a folder and go back to their shift.
No, and that's what makes this so fraught. The clinicians are still treating these children, titrating respiratory support, monitoring for complications, administering antidotes if indicated. Meanwhile, police are asking him to document everything, the exact timeline of symptoms, the precise wording parents used, the condition of the food containers. They're functioning in two roles simultaneously, and those roles can conflict. The therapeutic relationship with the family is built on trust. The investigative relationship requires a certain skepticism. Holding both at once is exhausting.
Before we get deeper into that tension, let me ask about the surveillance systems. You mentioned the nurse's gut feeling, but there are automated systems watching for this too, right?
Yes, and they're increasingly sophisticated. The CDC runs BioSense, which monitors emergency department chief complaints in real time across thousands of hospitals, looking for statistical anomalies. Israel has a syndromic surveillance system integrated into its national health network. But here's the thing. These systems are designed for population-level detection, bioterrorism, pandemic influenza, widespread foodborne outbreaks. A cluster of three infants in one emergency department in one night might not trigger an automated alert at all. The sample size is too small for the algorithm to flag. The human element, the nurse looking at the board, remains irreplaceable for these small, targeted events.
Which is unsettling. The system designed to catch this might miss it precisely because it's too small, too focused.
That's why I keep coming back to the nurse. The automated systems are getting better. AI-driven syndromic surveillance, real-time pharmacy data. But the most important detection tool in a case like Jerusalem is still a human being who notices that two things don't belong together.
Let's follow the thread. The common exposure is identified. A specific puree from a specific supermarket. The police are now involved. The investigation has to figure out what kind of event this is, and the possibilities are very different.
Three main scenarios. First, accidental food contamination. A manufacturing error, a bacterial outbreak in the supply chain. Second, what Daniel called the rogue doctor, someone inside the healthcare system intentionally harming patients. Third, the rogue employee, someone at the point of sale tampering with product. Each leaves a different epidemiological footprint.
Walk me through those footprints.
Accidental contamination tends to be geographically dispersed. If the puree was contaminated at the factory, you'd see cases across multiple cities, multiple supermarket chains, wherever that batch was distributed. A rogue doctor, the Munchausen by proxy, or intentional poisoning scenario within a hospital shows a completely different pattern. The cases cluster in a single unit or a single shift. They're not linked by a consumer product at all. They're linked by a person with access to patients. The 2014 Texas case is the textbook example. A pharmacist noticed an unusual pattern of hypoglycemic events on one ward, patients with dangerously low blood sugar who had no clinical reason for it. That pattern pointed to a nurse poisoning patients with insulin. The cluster was confined to her shifts.
The rogue employee scenario? The Jerusalem scenario?
That's the tightest geographic signature. Cases linked to a single retail location. Not a factory, not a distribution center, one store. The contaminated product was purchased at that specific place. That's what the parents' interviews revealed in Jerusalem, and that's what pointed police toward the supermarket employee rather than a manufacturer or a healthcare worker. The pattern tells you where to look.
The epidemiological footprint is almost like a fingerprint. The shape of the cluster points to the category of perpetrator.
The speed with which you identify that shape determines how many more people get hurt. In the 1982 Tylenol cyanide poisonings, it was an emergency physician in the Chicago area who connected 7 deaths in 48 hours. He wasn't working from a centralized database. He was working from phone calls with other hospitals, comparing notes, realizing the common thread was Tylenol capsules. That case transformed product packaging forever, but it also demonstrated something essential. The detective work happens at the clinical level, not the administrative level. It's doctors and nurses talking to each other.
7 deaths in 48 hours. That's the kind of timeline where every hour you don't see the pattern costs lives.
That's the weight these clinicians carry. The Jerusalem case, thank God, didn't have fatalities, but the potential was there. Benzodiazepine overdose in an infant can cause respiratory arrest. These babies were intubated in intensive care. The only reason they survived is that the detection happened fast and the supportive care was immediate.
Which brings us to the people who've done this work before. The unsung heroes Daniel was asking about. You mentioned the Chicago physician in 1982. Who else should we know about?
Michael Shannon at Boston Children's Hospital, 1995. He's a pediatric emergency physician, and over a short period he sees 3 children with unexplained metabolic acidosis, a condition where the blood becomes dangerously acidic. It's rare in children, especially with no obvious cause. He notices that all 3 children had received the same intravenous medication from the same hospital supply. He traced the contamination to ethylene glycol, antifreeze, that had somehow entered the medication supply chain. He caught it before more children were exposed. That's pure medical detective work. He didn't have a surveillance system. He had a pattern and the tenacity to chase it.
3 children with the same rare metabolic profile. That strange moment at a much more specialized level.
Then there's the 2014 Texas case. The pharmacist who noticed the hypoglycemic events, her name isn't as widely known, but she's exactly the kind of unsung hero Daniel is asking about. She was reviewing lab values, saw a cluster of severe hypoglycemia on one ward that didn't match the patient's clinical histories. No diabetics, no insulin orders, no logical explanation. She pulled the records, mapped the events to shifts, and identified the pattern. That's not in her job description. Nobody trained her to be a detective. She just saw something wrong and refused to let it go.
There's a common thread in all of these. It's not just pattern recognition. It's the willingness to act on it. To be the person who says this doesn't make sense and then does the work to prove why.
That's harder than it sounds. Hospitals are busy, chaotic places. The default response to an anomaly is often to treat the patient in front of you and move on. Flagging a pattern means extra work, extra documentation, and the possibility that you're wrong and you've wasted everyone's time. The psychologists who study this call it diagnostic momentum. Once a patient is labeled with a particular condition, it's hard to shift the team's thinking. Breaking that momentum requires someone willing to be the squeaky wheel.
What does all this mean for the people on the front lines, and for the rest of us who might one day find ourselves in that emergency department?
For clinicians, the practical lesson is brutally simple. If you see 2 unusual cases in one shift, stop and ask what connects them before you treat the third. The pattern is often visible only in the first 24 hours. After that, the cases blur into the background noise and the thread gets lost.
For the rest of us, the parents, the families, the lesson is almost harder. If your child is part of a suspected cluster, the medical team is going to ask you questions that feel accusatory. They're going to want to know exactly what you fed your baby, where you bought it, whether you noticed anything odd about the packaging. They might ask about medications in your home, about who had access to your child. It's going to feel like they're investigating you.
They are, in a sense. Not because they think you did it, but because they have to eliminate every variable. The exposure history is a diagnostic tool, not a moral judgment. But try telling that to a parent whose infant is on a ventilator and who's just been asked whether they keep benzodiazepines in the house. The emotional whiplash is real.
There's a training gap here. Hospitals don't typically prepare staff for how to conduct what is essentially a forensic interview, while maintaining a therapeutic relationship.
No, and it shows. I've watched it go wrong. A well-meaning resident asks a question too bluntly, the parents shut down, and suddenly you've lost your best source of information. The places that do this well train their staff in trauma-informed interviewing. You explain why you're asking before you ask. You normalize the process. We're asking every family these same questions because we're trying to find what these cases have in common. You make it clear the parent is your partner in the investigation, not its subject.
Which brings us back to the systemic question. Every emergency department should have a cluster trigger protocol, a simple checklist that any nurse or doctor can activate when they suspect a pattern. Does that exist as a standard?
Not universally, and that's the problem. Some hospitals have it baked into their incident command structure. Others rely on individual clinicians having the instinct and the courage to speak up. The Jerusalem case is going to change that conversation, I think. When the dust settles, there will be a push, at least in Israel, to formalize the cluster detection process in pediatric emergency departments. A mandatory reporting trigger for any two cases of unexplained altered mental status in infants within a single shift, for example.
The Jerusalem case might end up saving lives far beyond these specific children, not because of the criminal investigation, but because of the clinical protocol it forces into existence.
That's the strange legacy of these events. The 1982 Tylenol case gave us tamper-evident packaging. The Boston Children's case tightened hospital pharmacy supply chain monitoring. The Texas insulin case led to enhanced controlled substance tracking on hospital wards. Every tragedy rewrites the rules. The question is whether we can write the rules before the next tragedy instead of after.
You mentioned the 1982 Tylenol physician connecting 7 deaths by phone. What I find remarkable is that he wasn't working inside some formal detection infrastructure. He was just calling around to other hospitals, comparing notes. How does that compare to what we have now?
The tools are better, but the core mechanism hasn't changed. In 1982, the Chicago doctor, his name was Thomas Kim, a Korean-American emergency physician who never sought the spotlight, was essentially doing manual syndromic surveillance. Today, the CDC's BioSense platform ingests chief complaint data from thousands of emergency departments in near real time. But BioSense wasn't built for a cluster of 7. It's designed for population-level anomalies, hundreds of cases across a region. A small, targeted poisoning still lives in the blind spot between individual clinical observation and automated detection.
The human phone call hasn't been replaced. It's just been supplemented.
In some ways, the phone call is still faster. An algorithm needs enough data points to cross a statistical threshold. A nurse needs 2. The 2018 Listeria outbreak linked to cantaloupe is a good example of the hybrid model. The first signal didn't come from the CDC's PulseNet system. It came from an infection control nurse at a single hospital in Colorado who noticed 3 patients with the same rare Listeria serotype in 1 week. She called the state health department, they pulled the CDC's genomic sequencing data, and the match was confirmed within days. The system worked, but only because a human pushed the button.
The cascade is, nurse notices, infection control gets the call, health department confirms, and then at some point, police. Where exactly is that police trigger?
In most U.S. states, the health department makes the call. If the epidemiological investigation finds evidence of intentional contamination, tampered packaging, a pattern that points to a single point of sale rather than a production batch, the health commissioner notifies law enforcement. In Israel, the district health office escalates to the Ministry of Health, and if there's criminal suspicion, they bring in the police simultaneously with the epidemiological team. In Jerusalem, that handoff happened within hours of the common product being identified.
Once police are in, the medical staff are still treating patients. You mentioned that dual role earlier. What does that actually feel like on the ground?
It's disorienting. You're adjusting a ventilator on a 6-month-old while a police officer is asking you to document the exact words a parent used when describing where they bought the baby food. The clinical part of your brain is running protocols: airway, breathing, circulation. The investigative part is trying to preserve details that might matter in court. Those two modes don't coexist comfortably. Most clinicians learn by doing, and the first time is always jarring.
I'd imagine it also changes how you look at the parents.
It does, and that's the part nobody likes to talk about. The parents are your primary source of exposure history. They're also, statistically, the most likely perpetrators in any pediatric poisoning. That's just the epidemiology. So you're sitting with a mother whose baby is critically ill, and part of your mind is cataloging whether her story is consistent, whether her affect matches the situation. You're providing compassionate care while simultaneously running a mental credibility assessment. It's exhausting and morally complicated.
In the Jerusalem case, the parents turned out to be the victims too. Their interviews were what cracked the case open.
They were the key witnesses and the secondary victims in the same moment. That's why the interview technique matters so much. If you approach them with suspicion, they'll sense it and shut down. If you approach them as partners, "We need your help to figure out what hurt your baby so we can protect other children," they'll give you details you'd never get from a hostile interview. The Jerusalem team got that right. The parents provided the brand, the store, the purchase timeline. That's gold-level epidemiological data, and it came from families in the worst moment of their lives.
You mentioned the three scenarios earlier. Contamination, rogue doctor, rogue employee. I want to sit with the rogue doctor one for a minute, because it's the one most people would never think to look for. How does a hospital even begin to suspect one of its own?
That's the hardest detection problem of the three, and it tears institutions apart. The Texas insulin case from 2014 is the clearest example. A pharmacist doing routine lab value review noticed that patients on one specific ward were having severe hypoglycemic events, and these weren't diabetic patients. There were no insulin orders on their charts. She pulled the records and mapped the events to shifts. Every episode happened when the same nurse was on duty.
A pharmacist catching it. Someone whose job is literally just to verify that medications make sense, and she ended up cracking a criminal case.
She almost didn't. She told supervisors twice before anyone took it seriously. The institutional reluctance to believe a colleague could be harming patients is immense. It's not just loyalty, it's a kind of cognitive self-defense. If you accept that a nurse on your ward is poisoning babies, you have to accept that your entire system of supervision and trust has failed. That's a harder threshold to cross than identifying a contaminated product from a factory.
The rogue doctor or rogue nurse scenario has a built-in detection delay that the other two don't.
With food contamination, you're looking for a product. With a rogue employee at a store, you're looking at a single retail location. Both are external to the hospital. But when the perpetrator is inside your own institution, every hour you spend not believing, it is an hour they keep having access to patients. The Texas pharmacist case moved slowly because the initial response from administration was essentially, "Are you sure?" She was sure. She had the data. But the system wasn't designed to hear what she was saying.
Which brings us to the names Daniel was asking about. The unsung heroes. You mentioned Dr. Michael Shannon at Boston Children's in 95. Tell me more about how he actually made that connection.
Shannon was a pediatric emergency physician, brilliant, meticulous. Over a span of days, he saw three children with severe metabolic acidosis. In children, the usual causes are diabetic ketoacidosis or toxic ingestion, antifreeze, basically. Ethylene glycol poisoning produces a very specific lab pattern, a high anion gap, a high osmolar gap, and calcium oxalate crystals in the urine. Shannon saw that pattern in three children who had no history of diabetes and no known ingestion. They were all post-surgical patients. They'd all received the same IV medication from the same hospital supply. He traced the contamination back to a compounding error that had introduced ethylene glycol into a batch of medication. He caught it before a fourth child was dosed.
That strange moment at a biochemical level. Most physicians would have treated the acidosis and moved on.
That's what makes Shannon remarkable. Treating the acidosis is the obvious clinical move. stopping to ask why three unrelated children have the same bizarre lab values. That's the detective move. He published the case, and it became a landmark in hospital pharmacy safety. But most people have never heard his name.
The Texas pharmacist. Does her name ever get cited?
These people tend to vanish into the institutional memory of the cases they solved. The investigation becomes famous, the perpetrator becomes infamous, and the person who first said something's wrong goes back to their job. It's almost a structural anonymity. The system absorbs the lesson but forgets the teacher.
Which is exactly why Daniel's question matters. He's asking us to name them.
There's another one. Dr. Robert Mueleman goes by Skip, emergency physician in Nebraska. In the late 90s, he noticed a cluster of patients with unexplained hypoglycemia and eventually connected it to insulin poisoning. The pattern was subtle because the patients were spread across different days and different attending physicians. Mueleman pulled the records, mapped the timeline, and realized the events clustered around a single healthcare worker. He didn't have a surveillance system. He had a hunch and the discipline to chase it through the data.
The Texas pharmacist whose name we should know but don't. And Thomas Kim in Chicago in 82. That's a small, strange club.
They all share something. None of them were doing what their job description said. Shannon was supposed to stabilize and discharge. The Texas pharmacist was supposed to verify orders. Mueleman was supposed to treat emergencies. Kim was supposed to run his shift. Every single one stepped outside their role and said, "I need to understand why this is happening." That's not a skill you can train, it's a disposition.
That's the psychological profile of the medical detective. Now I want to flip it. What happens to the doctor-patient relationship when the doctor has to become that detective? You touched on it earlier. The parent interview that feels like an interrogation.
It's the hardest tightrope in medicine. You're sitting with a mother whose baby is on a ventilator, and you need to ask her whether she keeps sedatives in the house, whether anyone else had access to the baby's food, whether she noticed anything unusual about the jar when she opened it. Every question carries an implicit accusation, even if you don't mean it that way. And the parent is already in the worst moment of their life. Their child is critically ill. They're sleep-deprived, terrified, probably blaming themselves. Now a doctor is asking questions that sound like they're trying to build a case.
In some cases, they are building a case. Munchausen, by proxy, is real.
It's real, and it's one of the hardest diagnoses in pediatrics. The parent, almost always the mother, is intentionally making the child sick to get medical attention. The prevalence is low, but the mortality is high. Something like 6-9% of these cases end in the child's death, so the physician can't just assume good faith. They have to hold two contradictory postures simultaneously. I am here to help you and your child, and I need to verify everything you're telling me. That's psychologically unsustainable over a long period. Most clinicians can do it for a shift, maybe two. Then it starts to corrode something.
How do the good ones manage it?
The places that train for this teach a technique called structured non-accusatory interviewing. You frame every question as part of a standard protocol. We ask every family these questions when we see this cluster of symptoms. You make the process visible. You explain why you're asking before you ask. You never let the parent feel singled out. And you assign the interview to someone who isn't the primary treating clinician whenever possible. A social worker, a child protection specialist, someone who can ask hard questions without contaminating the therapeutic relationship.
That's the ideal. What happens in reality?
Most hospitals don't have that ideal. You get a resident who's been awake for 18 hours trying to ask sensitive questions between intubation checks. The Jerusalem team had the advantage of a clear, common product, the puree, so the interview could focus on purchase details rather than parenting. That made it easier. But easier is relative when you're interviewing parents of babies in respiratory failure.
Let me pull this towards something concrete. You've been on both sides. The clinician treating the patient and the analyst looking at the system. What's the one thing you'd change tomorrow if you could?
Every emergency department should have a cluster trigger protocol. Not a guideline, not a suggestion, a protocol. A single-page checklist that any nurse or doctor can activate. Two unusual cases with the same chief complaint in one shift, you pull the trigger. It initiates a structured exposure history, notifies infection control, and starts the clock on the health department notification. No permission needed. No waiting for the attending to finish their coffee.
Right now, that doesn't exist as a standard.
It exists in pieces. Some hospitals have it buried in their incident command manual. Others rely on the charge nurse having enough experience and confidence to escalate. But there's no universal standard, no joint commission requirement, nothing that says this is how you catch a cluster before it becomes an outbreak. The Jerusalem case is going to change that conversation, especially in Israel. When you have multiple infants poisoned by a single product from a single store, the post-incident review is going to ask one question: how fast did the system respond? And the answer will determine whether protocols get rewritten.
There's an advocacy angle here. If you're a healthcare professional listening to this, the thing you can do on your next shift is ask whether your department has that protocol. And if it doesn't, push for one.
If you're not a healthcare professional, if you're a parent, a citizen, the actionable piece is different. It's understanding that if your loved one is part of a suspected cluster, the questions are going to feel uncomfortable. They're going to ask about what you fed your child, where you bought it, who had access. They might ask about medications in your home. They're not accusing you. They're trying to find the common thread before someone else gets hurt.
That's a hard thing to internalize in the moment. Your kid is sick, you're terrified, and someone in scrubs is asking whether you noticed anything odd about the jar of baby food. The natural reaction is, why are you asking me this instead of treating my child?
The answer, which nobody has time to give in the moment, is because treating your child and finding the source are the same thing. If you don't identify the common exposure, you can't stop the next case from arriving. The interview is treatment. It just doesn't feel like it.
Which is why the framing matters so much, though we ask every family these questions, approach, making the parent a partner instead of a subject.
The Jerusalem team got that right. The parents gave them the brand, the store, the timeline. That data moved faster than any lab test could have. Within hours, the health department had pulled product from shelves. The cluster stopped. That's the ideal outcome: detection, identification, intervention, all in one shift. But it only works if the parents trust the people asking the questions.
Trust is built on transparency. If the system doesn't explain itself, it looks like an interrogation. If it does, it looks like a rescue.
That's the whole thing in one sentence.
Which leaves us with one final question. As the surveillance systems get smarter, AI-driven syndromic detection, real-time pharmacy data flagging unusual dispensing patterns, does the human detective role become obsolete? Or will the most important detection always be a nurse looking at the board and saying, this feels wrong?
I keep coming back to the sample size problem. An algorithm needs enough data points to cross a statistical threshold. The Jerusalem cluster was 3 infants. The Tylenol case was 7 deaths across multiple hospitals that no single database was tracking. The Texas insulin case was caught by a pharmacist reviewing individual lab values, not by a system-level alert. These events are too small, too localized, and too weird for any algorithm to flag reliably. The AI is looking for the epidemic. The nurse is looking at the patient in bed too.
The machine is watching the forest, and the human is watching the trees. But the fire starts as a single match.
The match is always lit before the smoke reaches the canopy. Syndromic surveillance is getting genuinely impressive. Israel's system can detect a spike in respiratory complaints in a specific district within hours, but it's designed for mass events. A handful of poisoned infants in one emergency department doesn't register as a statistical event. It registers as a clinical anomaly, and the only instrument that catches clinical anomalies is a trained human paying attention.
Which is unsettling if you're the kind of person who assumes the systems are watching.
The systems are watching for the wrong thing in this context. They're watching for scale. These attacks are defined by their smallness. That's what makes them hard to catch and, in a twisted way, what makes them attractive to the perpetrator. You poison a batch of baby food at one supermarket, you get a handful of cases. You poison the factory, you get hundreds, and the FBI is at your door in a day. The small attack exploits the blind spot between individual care and population surveillance.
The future isn't replacing the nurse with an algorithm. It's building systems that amplify the nurse's hunch.
The best model is the hybrid one. The Colorado Listeria case from 2018, where the infection control nurse spotted 3 cases, called the state, and the CDC's genomic sequencing confirmed the match. The human pushed the button, the machine accelerated the confirmation. That's where this should go. Real-time data sharing between emergency departments so that when a nurse in Jerusalem says, "That's strange," a nurse in Tel Aviv can see the same anomaly if it appears there. Not replacing the hunch, connecting the hunches.
The Jerusalem case might end up being a proof of concept for something. Not just tamper-evident packaging, though I'd bet real money that's coming, but a formalized cluster detection protocol in pediatric emergency departments. A mandatory trigger for any two cases of unexplained altered mental status in infants within a single shift.
I think that's almost certain. The post-incident review will ask how fast the system responded, and the answer, which was fast, to be clear, the Jerusalem team did this well, will still reveal gaps that can be closed. And when those gaps get closed in Israel, other countries will look at the protocol and adapt it. That's how these things ripple outward. The Tylenol case gave us tamper-evident seals worldwide. The Boston Children's case tightened hospital pharmacy monitoring. Every tragedy rewrites the rules, but only if someone writes them.
The bigger lesson isn't about packaging or protocols. It's about the invisible work. The people we don't name. The charge nurse, the pharmacist, the attending physician who made the phone call, who saw a pattern before it was a pattern and acted before they had proof. The Jerusalem case has those people. We don't know their names yet, and we might never. But they're the reason those babies are alive.
That's the thing I want to land. The unsung heroes Daniel asked about. Michael Shannon, Skip Mueleman, the Texas pharmacist, Thomas Kim in Chicago. They're a tiny sample of a much larger group. Most of these detections never make the news. The cluster gets stopped, the product gets pulled, the perpetrator gets caught, and the person who first said something's wrong goes back to their shift. The system absorbs the lesson and forgets the teacher. But the teacher is the whole reason the lesson exists.
That's worth naming, even when we can't name them.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1980s, biologists studying the cichlid fishes of Lake Tanganyika discovered a species that had completely lost its eyes over evolutionary time, a condition known as stygiophthalmy, from the Greek stygios, referring to the river Styx, and ophthalmos, meaning eye. The term literally translates to stygian-eyed, a reference to the underworld darkness these cave-adapted fish inhabit.
That's going to stick with me.
So if the Jerusalem case teaches us anything, it's that the most important safety system in medicine isn't a database or an algorithm. It's a person who trusts their unease long enough to act on it. The question is whether we're building systems that honor that, or systems that assume the machine will catch it and let the human instinct atrophy. I don't think we know the answer yet, but I think the next decade of these cases will tell us.
This has been my Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you got something out of this episode, leave us a review wherever you listen. It's the best way to help more people find the show. We'll be back soon.
Talk to you then.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.